Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I just want to thank you all for coming out tonight, and also thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. We all really appreciate your support. Well, we're delighted tonight to start off with Anne Waldman and Laura Wright. They're here with their new book, Cross Worlds, Transcultural Poetics, an Anthology. And we also have the author of You Animal Machine, The Golden Greek, by Elena Sikelianos. And she's going to be doing some reading that's also in the anthology as well. To start, as many of you here tonight know, Anne Waldman is not only an accomplished poet of over 40 collections of her own poetry, she is also a professor, a dynamic performer, a cultural activist, and the co-founder with Allen Ginsberg of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. She is the winner of the Shelley Memorial Award and the 2012 USA Penn Center Award for Poetry for her feminist epic, the Jovis Trilogy, Colors in the Mechanism of Concealment. Anne Waldman received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2013-2014 and is Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. Laura Wright is co-editor of The Beats of Naropa that was published in 2009. She's a poet, a librarian, a translator, a volunteer firefighter, and graduate of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. For a number of years, she curated the Left Hand Reading Series in Boulder. Laura Wright is the author of Part of the Design, as well as various chapbooks. Now, will you please join me in welcoming all three of our wonderful authors tonight?
And I'm going to give an introduction for Eleni Sikelianos. Sikelianos. Yeah. My mother was a Sikelianos. There's a family connection here, but it's not nepotistic. Eleni is the author of 6 books of poetry, most recently The Loving Detail of the Living and the Dead, a Library Journal Best Book of 2013, and The California Poem, as well as a hybrid memoir, The Book of John, which was a Barnes & Noble Best of the Year. A California native, longtime New Yorker, and world traveler, she now lives in Boulder with her husband, the novelist Laird Hunt, and their daughter, Eva Grace. And Eleni has also been a major force in the Kerouac School vision at Naropa University, a graduate of that program, and also taught there for many years and continues to teach and read and perform and work with us, particularly during the summer writing program time in the summers. And she also works at the terrific writing program, the PhD program, and also working with the creative work of the PhD students. Some of them are here tonight, I hope. And great to see you. And is a masterful teacher as well. So we're all here representing these different worlds, and she'll be reading a bit from this You Animal Machine, the new memoir, family memoir. So I'm going to begin talking about Cross Worlds. This is a real labor of love. I think a very, very exciting book. We're still very excited by it, and I find myself reading it, you know, after proofing it, and being present for a lot of the initial presentations, because the bulk of this book comes out of the pedagogy of the Jack Kerouac School, and the sheer sort of diversity of the people in this collection, I think, is really unusual and quite unique in a way to this conference that we have yearly every summer. I think that there's something about the vision and the ethos of the Kerouac School that has brought these people together in these diverse ways. And so it's not just people representing their culture, talking about where they're from, but for example, having Allen Ginsberg travel to Arnhem Land in Australia and meet the Aborigine elders and learn something of that tradition and that influences his own work. And so he presented his piece, and I'll read a little bit from that at a Naropa session. So all these pieces in here, which are essays, lectures, talks, panels, interviews, were in a, you know, interesting dynamic of, in many cases, on the spot and being the oral diversity, the conversation amongst the people on, as you'll see in some of the panel presentations, is very fresh and alive and vibrant and interesting. So that's what particularly attracts me to this book. And Laura is an amazing editor and transcriber and actually enjoys hearing the voices as she sits there in one of those awful machines. So I really owe so much to her for that kind of dedication. And then putting it together as text is always very interesting. And the arrangement, we really get involved with, you know, what goes. It's not just a linear progression necessarily. So there's a, you know, a sense of these dynamic topics and presentations coming together in a way. So it's a very creative act. And I recommend, even if you're poets and novelists and so on, try doing an anthology sometime. It's really a challenge. So I'll read a couple of lines from the intro. We also dedicate the book to a dear comrade, Anselm Hallo, originally from Finland. Maybe some of you know of his work. He taught at Naropa many years and passed away recently. So we dedicate the book to Anselm, and we quote from his poem At Evenfall, which says, never please wicked money. Always treat language like a dangerous toy. So that was one of the impulses here. And because there's also work in translation in this book, that's a kind of added gift, I think, to the whole collection. Okay, so intro. While the universe may be expanding, the world we live in is shrinking, in that we all dwell in the Anthropocene, a geological age defined by the antics and greed and curiosity and bellicose nature of Homo sapiens sapiens. As we wreak havoc on our ecosystems, our land, our flora and fauna, how do we continue the conversation as poets, activists, and cultural workers? Is our talk beside the point? Isn't discourse one of our smarter human endeavors, though? Artists arrive and strive to do this, we believe, to keep dialogue, inquiry, and information passed on, and knowledge of poetics, place, history, and consciousness moving along, to not be alone in the void, to engage in invigorated ideas and language. The poet is by nature an investigator, a thinker, a weaver, a magician, making up the world again and again. How do we come to terms with our own mind in relation to other places and cultures? How open are we? How does our creative education continue along? We seem to be obsessively wired up and conduct much, if not most, of our exchanges, verbal, literary, imaginative, business, online. We are in a new and still evolving mode of cross-cultural, transnational, and international commerce in terms of our daily discourse. Yet we still thrive on the personal, physical exchange. It buoys us up. We travel and take notes and report on where we've been and what new contexts and persons and perspectives are circulating. We are inspired by the presence of others in this room, specifically in the zone and annals and archives of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University, from which this book derives its pulse and purpose. This is an anthology of artists, poets, novelists, hybrid writers, playwrights, philosophers, and translators, of essays speaking on what happens both between and across spaces, locations, language, genres, and media. And this is an anthology that returns again and again to language. Language as culture. Language as medium. Language as artifact. Language as identity. Language as agent of and as charged by globalization. Language as practice, language as fact. What unites these explorations is an engagement with the other, a willingness not just to visit, but to inhabit, to occupy and explore what is between. To translate in its most literal sense is to carry across. This collection is a chronological tour of the borderlands, the interstices, and around the complexities of translating ideas, intention, and the music of verse from one language to another. In these unmapped territories of the between, it becomes difficult to separate the physical from the cultural and the cultural from the linguistic. And just a few examples, in some cases, there is less between than we might hope, as in Andre Codrescu's description of Romania in 1989, in which we find much sadly still relevant to the media and public understanding, or lack thereof, of events in the 21st century. Myung-Mi Kim interrogates one word at a time. Harriet Mullen considers the ethical obligation we have to be aware and attentive. And Hua Win illustrates the results of paying attention to personal narrative in its broader context. Judith Molina and Hanan Reznikoff's resounding report on the ongoing legacy of the living theater around the world, and so on. So many, many people represented in this book. And we open with a beautiful wolf song, a wolf song transmission, which I invite you to read and vocalize and send me a recording. Okay, so these are great Aborigine sticks brought from Arnhem Land by Allen Ginsberg from this trip, actually. And he presented this talk in 1976. So we're drawing very much on our archive at Naropa, considering that part of our, you know, spiritual and linguistic legacy. And in this piece, he speaks of the ancient form of poetics, which is one of the oldest in the world, is the Australian Aborigine practice. They have epic material so that it sometimes takes 40 years to become a songman. To become a songman in the Pitjantjatjara tongue, which is Central Australian, or in Arnhem Land among the Yirrkala tribes, involves memorizing epic material that covers a cycle of migration that the tribe takes over anywhere from 20 to 40 years. That's why it might take that long to become a songman, because one main form of the epic is a long song, which is sung continuously over a cycle of 20 years, which involves travel instructions on a circular migration pattern. They eat grubs, insects, sleepy lizards. You might have to have a direction if you arrive at a campsite which has traditionally been used before over millennia. The last time the tribe was there, all the witchetty grubs and the sleepy lizards were eaten up, and it may take 20 or 30 years to replenish the natural foodstuffs, so that would be the length of the cycle of traveling. A wandering epic might involve the total botany of the terrain that the tribe is going to circumambulate, where you can find water holes, what kind of vegetation is around, what kind of food is around, where you can find firewood if you build any sort of fire, what are the local landmarks, how are they connected in eternal dream time to the origin of the earth and of the tribe, where is the best place for sports and games, what is the history of the place. The songman uses a very simple form, a one-line verse, which is then repeated by the entire tribe, which might be anywhere from 5 to 50 or over 100 people. You have to have small groups if you're traveling in a continuously nomadic existence like this. And the songmen use song sticks along with the verses to mark time and to lead the rest of the village in chanting. The songman is the only one that has in his head the entire stock of words and information, like what birds are around in what season, where the stars will be at a certain point, where the moon will rise and where the sun will rise, where the moon will set and where the sun will set. A lot of the older villagers can remember fragments. fragments of it, but the songman's profession is to keep track of everything. So the entire village is dependent on the poet. The poet has the equivalent of the Encyclopedia Britannica in his head and is the only one who has specific instructions on how to arrive in specific places. So the song sticks are for keeping time. Almost every elder will have these sticks, sometimes carved with maps, geographical directions, sometimes carved with messages, and so on. So I'm going to, this is a piece Alan used to recite, and this is from Approaching Ayers Rock. In the center of Australia is Ayers Rock, a large sandstone monolith. It is porous, so it collects water. Water is continually dripping through the center of it, down to pools around the edge, on the shady side, and on the sunny side. It has become a sacred place for Central Australian tribes to do ceremonies and stop at. So this is the Uluru, or Ayers Rock, and it was written on a plane approaching Ayers Rock. When the red pond fills, fish appear. When the red pond fills, fish appear. When the red pond fills, fish appear. When the red pond dries, fish disappear. When the red pond dries, fish disappear. When the red pond dries, fish disappear. Everything built on the desert crumbles to dust. Everything built on the desert crumbles to dust. Everything built on the desert crumbles to dust. Electric cable transmission wires swept down. Electric cable transmission wires swept down. Electric cable transmission wires swept down. The lizard people came out of the rock. The lizard people came out of the rock. The lizard people came out of the rock. And it goes on. The red kangaroo people make a visit. And just a little bit also of another piece that was composed by Alan, influenced by this experience of traveling to Australia and meeting the Aborigine songmen. He talks about, quote, I tried applying that to the Vietnam War in terms of stopping the bombing, thinking it was such a basic form. It would be a way to get attention in large rallies and also get across a very simple message. Wandering around in peace rallies over a two-year period, I evolved a chant which I use with Australian Aborigine song sticks. It varies with the locality and is repetitive naturally. I wanted to say Alan was extraordinary in that, you know, he went to India in the 60s and came back with mantra that he then used in this political context. He would invoke mantra at political rallies, mantra to bring down the Pentagon, mantra to still a crowd of thousands of people, thousands of protesters, for example, at the, you know, the Democratic Convention, and so on. So it's interesting how he would go to Arnhem Land and come back with these song sticks and be thinking about the Vietnam War, stopping the Vietnam War, and how this skillful means of art of this particular tradition could, you know, come into that. And, you know, again, remembering him with this piece. Whom bomb, we bomb them. Whom bomb, we bomb them. Whom bomb, we bomb them. What do? We bomb. We bomb them. What do? We bomb. We bomb them. What do? We bomb. We bomb them. What do? Who do we bomb? What do? Who do we bomb? What do? Who do we bomb? Whom bomb? We bomb them. Whom bomb? We bomb them. Whom bomb? You bomb you. Whom bomb? You bomb you. Stop the electric bomb war. Stop Nam war. Stop the electric bomb war. Stop Nam war. Stop the electric bomb war. Stop Nam war. Stop damn robot wars. Stop damn robot wars. Stop damn robot wars. Nixon Quaker, quit your bomb. Nixon Quaker, stop your bomb. Hebrew, stop your bomb. Laird, Laird, stop your bomb. Nixon, Nixon, stop your bomb. Stop the bomb, stop the bomb. Stop, stop, stop the bomb. Stop the bomb, stop the bomb. Stop, stop, stop the bomb. So just a couple of other, a very wonderful essay by Peter Lamborn Wilson, Aka Hakim Bey. Maybe some of you know him by his other name. He wrote a wonderful book called TAZ, Temporary Autonomous Zone, which was published by City Lights. And this phrase I, you know, frequently invoke to talk about, you know, the kinds of things we do at Naropa. But this piece looks back at the Neanderthal and looks at, you know, the how every origin can be pushed back. That's the point I'm trying to make here. That's what he says. All the origins can be pushed back. You begin, as I did, with a fascination with early classical societies like Greece and Mesopotamia, and then you start going back. Under every fact, a trapdoor opens and drops you down, down into an archaeology of time. You discover that all those layers are still present. None of this has vanished. I'm not just talking about archaeological stratigraphy, although that's part of it. Within every consciousness, there is and remains the hunter-gatherer consciousness, a Neolithic peasant consciousness. We are all still those people. It's only been the merest, briefest time since we were not those people. Secretly, we are all still those people. We have strong links of consciousness which connect us to those people which have been denied vigorously, hysterically, rigidly denied ever since the rise of civilization in the Fertile Crescent, whatever you want to call it. Actually, it was Northern Anatolia. I'll get to that later. So that's a taste. I find this essay very inspiring. I wish I was a redhead because then I'd know I had some Neanderthal. That's been coming out. When I dye my hair henna, I think, oh, I'm a Neanderthal. So that's Peter Wilson. There's a piece in here by Barbara Tedlock called Hidden Female Shamanic Traditions. There's a wonderful piece by Lorenzo Thomas, a very important African-American writer who calls his piece Talking Back to Whitman. And he defines, really gets into ethnicity and what that means, particularly in this culture, and what it means in poetry. And, you know, these are very dark, troubling times, as we're seeing, you know, playing out on our world stage here. And I find that the most interesting discourse often is through the poets. And that's why we also invoke Pound's old phrase, poetry is news. So go to poetry for the news. I want to start a TV program, Poetry is News, and I'll give you a daily report. Anyway, he talks about how American ethnic groups are fictitious. If you take, for example, the category Asian American, this is supposed to include people from India, Pakistan, Korea, Laos, China, Japan, the Philippines, and a few other places. In a book edited by Ishmael Reed called Multi-America, Amrijit Singh, a wonderful literary critic whose specialty is the Harlem Renaissance, points out that the categories South Asian or Asian American are very conscious political decisions made by people in the United States of America and the United States Census Department to create a political entity. Looking at the concept of Hispanic or Latino, which, by the way, I think is a terrible word for etymological reasons, that too is supposed to embrace people of Mexican descent living in what is now the United States. They used to be Mexico, people from Puerto Rico who are American citizens since the beginning of the 20th century, people from Central and South America, and perhaps even people from Spain or the Canary Islands. Again, if you think about it, people from these different areas don't speak the same Spanish. There's a difference between the Spanish of Nicaragua and that of Mexico, that of Puerto Rico, etc. African American is a fictional quantity in another sense, less so perhaps an Asian American or Hispanic American, because African American simply means people of African descent, that is, people of noticeable African descent. But when we use that phrase, it includes people who are five-star generals, chief executive officers of the largest food corporation on earth, Reginald Lewis at Beatrice Incorporated, and people who live in communities where 40% of the black men are unemployed, and everybody in between. Somehow, all of this is the African-American group. The other group, white, is even more of a fictitious construction than the others, and so on. So I'm trying to give you some of these ideas to chew over. And then Pierre Joris has a terrific piece on Arab poetics. It's called Arabic Poetics in the International Literary Scene. And he opens with a beautiful passage from the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, talking about, it's in his book, which one of his books. It's one of the book it's set in Lebanon. Memory of Forgetfulness, yeah. And again, I learn so much from these people and so on. And then we have Linh Dinh, Vietnamese origin, who talks about different poets, the different poets of Vietnam, with wonderful selections from their work. And I'll wind it up in a moment. This is Night's Dawn by Phan Nhien Hau. These are the invited secrets in the middle of the night toward dawn. You tap the face of the clock with a hammer. The ceiling fan rotates beneath the moon, breathing in the smells of the city the way it was. This is another way to step out of the blinding roars of the poisonous night, but you rejected it. The ceiling fan and the flowers shed their petals. Dawn repeats, homicide and a child eaten by dogs. There is another way to stop halfway between two asphyxiations, but still you swim toward the sea, toward the secrets of the kelp. And then Sherwin Bitsui, a Diné Navajo poet who has frequently graces us at Naropa and actually came to Naropa first as a student during the summer session. When I was starting college, I had just gotten out of high school, and I grew up on the reservation. Every morning and every evening, I would cross the border. I would cross a physical, cultural, linguistic border. I felt like, as I crossed that border, people did different things in the city. Or it wasn't even a city. It was a small, one main street town called Holbrook, and I carried that border within me throughout my whole life. I carry it with me today. I don't know who empowered that border. I don't know if I keep fanning the flames or if I keep it alive inside me, because that is my origin. That is my place. I speak both languages. I speak Navajo, and I also speak English. In Navajo, we call the language Diné. This notion of always having to cross is certainly part of my own work. It is part of the consciousness of many Native people in this country. Our languages are the languages of this land. They are the languages that have been sculpted by the land. They are thousands of years old. They are sometimes continuous, and a lot of them are discontinuing as we speak. And we end with David Henderson actually talking about Amedi Baraka, the great radical African-American poet who is still very much alive, certainly in my consciousness, and thinking about him in the context of what's going on in Ferguson and how he would see this as an opportunity to actually build something constructive. He talked all the time to us at Naropa about cultural revolution and about common ground and finding our common ground. So I think that's one of the inspirations of this book, is to find common ground based in this exploration of language and idea, the great logopoeia, the dance of the intellect, and the melopoeia of so much of the text, which reverts back to poetry, and the phanopoeia, which are the images cast in our mind as we, you know, travel some of this terrain. So I'm very grateful to inaugurate this book here tonight for you. And I welcome Laura Wright, co-editor, dear friend.
Thank you, Anne. I'm just going to read a couple brief selections, not of my favorite pieces. I can't play favorites with this book, but I wanted to honor first Akilah Oliver, a dear friend who lived in Boulder for many years. This is from a panel on cultural activism. She says, "I'm concerned about graffiti art. I'm concerned about insurgent, invisible, absent bodies and how they articulate, how they write, how that changes the cultural landscape, how that investigates the cultural landscape, how it challenges it, how graffiti writing specifically is a form of cultural activism. The absent, visible body, that is, the people who actually go out and write on walls, are both visible and invisible. In the act of writing, they are not seen. What is seen is the result, the product. The bodies themselves are those absent, visible bodies. Guerrilla tactics, Those bodies strike, they retreat. In striking, they change the landscape. They alter the public imagination, i.e. political space. They force a discourse that is outside of the script or outside of how those expected bodies are prescribed to speak. The techniques that inform the style of their writing are part of the discourse, though we don't necessarily see that discourse happening. It is an articulate conversation that the writers themselves, in crews or individually, have between themselves. When it comes out as code, how does it challenge how I see, how I read? How does it challenge the sacred space of advertising? What does it do when it invades the public imagination, whether we choose to read it or not? It still becomes part of our discourse. In trying to ignore it, it becomes a counter-discourse. I am calling the graffiti writers the phantom transient body, the phantom transient body that is a specter, again, the seen, not seen, and that is also the moving body, or that creates a nomadic discourse or language, a language that physically, if painted on trains, moves from one location to the other, hitching a ride on freight, a language that positions itself on billboards, on the sides of walls, any public space that can contain it. Amanda Viteri is a student who wrote an excellent thesis on graffiti art called The Adjacent Light. I want to quote a bit from her thesis on this sense of the nomadic relationship between graffiti and the public imagination. She does an excellent job of setting up this idea of nomadic writing. Quote, "Now having a sense of nomadology as an alternative way of looking at and using language, one returns to the contrast between how public space is viewed by the nomad and similarly the hip-hop movement to that of the state and how this difference may be significant. A basic example for comparing these differing views may be found in the ways in which shared public space will be occupied by the state versus how it would be occupied by the nomad." In this analysis, In this analysis, the graffiti writer is also the nomad, that transient phantom body that appears, that strikes, that paints, that creates, that alters the public imagination and alters for convenience what could be called the state, complicating or troubling the position of the graffiti writer as the specter or the phantom. The absent writer or the absent author is that we know very well that this specter, this phantom, is embodied. There is an author somewhere who actually makes this language, but the inability to locate the body is in itself another form of nomadic or insurgent or guerrilla writing. It forces a different kind of articulation. If we can't identify the body, then we can't attach an author to the language. How do we enter into discourse with it? How does that reshape how we think about writing as being something that is owned and authored, identifiable? Though this public or this absent visible body may not be present, that is in the public imagination, it is very much is speaking through a subject position. It very much is speaking from specific bodies, specific communities, specific aesthetic conceits, specific intents. In other words, graffiti is not random. The conversation that it incites is not random. My question is that a form of cultural activism? Is that a form of insurgency? And then I want to jump really quickly to a bit from Jack Collum, dear friend in Boulder, who we had hoped could be here tonight and couldn't, talking about ethics on a panel entitled Poethics. I'm going to start in the middle. Perhaps ethics means you place yourself, but then everything moves on you. The moral duty of an artist is to make and perhaps disseminate images and moves that advance thought. So what about the ethics of propaganda, of expressivity itself? Is it proper to color language? Can there be falsification for the sake of truth? I say yes, if we take truth to exist, but to always be in partial embryo or disintegration states, like the word nature is. In other words, sorta. In other words, talk as well as you can, but if you then find yourself leading the country, pause and take stock ethically. In other words, when the scientists try for objectivity, that's okay, but they shouldn't ever think they made it or could. In other words, ethics is to keep on dividing the remaining distance into halves unless you are a xenophobic. Ethics is the particulars of the general theory of good, or even spelling of good. Ethics could be quitting smoking because you respect yourself biologically enough to do what is possible to continue your work. Or it could be keeping on smoking because you feel a value in going contrary to sheer quantity. So ethics is like poetry itself. It certainly depends on uncertainty. It is composed of contradiction. But if you take that as a key, you have lost it.
Hi there. That was especially apropos to hear Akilah's piece. I'm sure that's why you chose it, thinking about the absent invisible body. And Akilah's pretty specifically talking about the absent invisible black body in that piece. Thank you for coming. Thank you so much to Tattered Cover and Marty for having us. It's so important to support these independent bookstores. I'm sure you guys have been following the battle between authors and Amazon, so these little refuges are so important, and it's part of this, these microcosms and overlapping communities that are represented in this amazing anthology and right here. Coffee House paired these books together. They came out in the same season with Coffee House in their nonfiction series. So that's why we're reading together. And so I'm going to read a little from this book that Coffee House is calling an essay. I think of it more as a hybrid memoir, anti-memoir, nonfiction, fiction, poetry book. Plus a few other things. But I was realizing as Anne and Laura were reading that although this book just came out, it really arose out of the community, the Naropa community. I was a student there 25 years ago, and the first poems, many of the first poems I was writing were poems about my family, and I really very distinctly remember Allen Ginsberg, it being workshopped by Allen Ginsberg, this poem about my grandmother, who's the central figure in this book. That poem has not survived. My grandmother's stories have. And also being inspired by this notion of archives, and I think part of the work that Laura and Anne are doing in this anthology is keeping these archives alive to us and keeping this knowledge and information circulating in the world. And so, but this is a little bit different kind of archive, family archive. This book, and I guess writing about family histories in general, was probably part of my initial impetus for becoming a writer. I have this crazy-ass family, and I needed to make sense of them. And much of the drive of for this book began with my grandmother's scrapbooks. And that can sound really terrible, right? I wrote this book as my grandmother's scrapbooks. You want to run the other way, or I would want to run the other way. My grandmother was a burlesque dancer. And so her scrapbooks were full of all her old showgirl pictures. And this is part of what I grew up with. So there's a big visual component. Let me see if I can. I often show slides when I read from this. I'm not doing that tonight. But for example, here's a picture of Granny. And so the middle portion of the book takes on, it sort of plays with her scrapbook. Many of them, they are her archives, but then playing with how they were placed in her archives. She was a pretty tough-ass woman. She did the nightclub circuit from Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, Cincinnati, all as far west as Denver. She danced at the Club Seven Seas, 17th and Tremont. It's no longer there. I looked. Colorado Springs, Greeley, as far south as somewhere in Kentucky, I can't remember where. So she was a single mom with three girls, including my mother, running the nightclub circuit in the 40s and 50s, and is the central figure for this hybrid book. And I'm gonna just jump around in it a little bit, and I'll start this is a series. The first book came out about 10 years ago, and that was about my father, who I also is a very colorful character. And this section just reprises something that began that book. This book is part of a longer family history, a circulatory system that encompasses morphine and heroin addicts, refugees, Ionian counts, one of the richest families in the United States who exhausted their fortune attempting to revive the ancient Greek theater, Lithuanian Jews, a half dozen musicians, a painter, several poets, one a Nobel nominee, and lesbians, opium runners, forgers, waitresses, tavern entertainers, a burlesque dancer called Milena the Leopard Girl, one of her many stage names, and a dwarf, one of her five husbands. All landed eventually on the coasts of our American homeland. It begins in lands and times we do not know, on the amber plains of Anatolia, under the golden light of Attica, in the shadows of the black forest, with shipfarers and wags, and snakes through the early reaches of recorded history on this continent, runs through Greek hash dens, Bohemian Europe and America, and crashes right into the average story of all those happy family plans gone awry. I see the lines of our ancestors laid out in filaments looping here and there, bifurcating, disappearing. There are breaks in the thread and dead ends into the dark where this or that sister took a boat from Greece and was lost forever from the fold. Men and women who found each other or for reasons of circumstance were thrust into each other's arms, radiating out along the great line in pairs. For however much they loved each other, or same or other sexes, or lived apart, always in this long arrow stretching back to our first humans hunting in the bush somewhere on a far continent in an inscrutable time, it was and is a man and a woman, two by two, each representing a small electrical hyphen of human intelligence and endeavor, illuminating the path that leads to me standing here. Men and women, each with eyes lit up for at least one moment in their lives, loving each other in the dark before the advent of writing, or a brief encounter, maybe forced, that led to the continuation of a line. These packets of genes waiting, and that uncontrollable animal urge toward making things. Love, babies, the ranks moving forward and forward, branching, fucking, splitting until they reach the edges of history, and forward farther till they hit the periphery of family lore. Thus begins the tale before human time, but in human terms, and stretches far beyond us into a future we cannot imagine, except perhaps that it will not contain us as walking libraries. It matters that there are holes in a family history that can never be filled, that there are secrets and mysteries, migrations and invasions and murky bloodlines. In this way, we speak of human history. The first portion of the tale was about my father, John. This portion of the tale is about the other side, my grandmother, the leopard girl, the golden Greek. These stories were always in the room with us, vapory house gods seeping up from the carpet, flitting around the cupboards and corners, sparking off fingertips like flammable ice, an aura crackling and chuckling around the skin, our lares familiars, our deep inhabitants. Story is not the right word. History is too vague. This is a net of family giftings woven in darkly luminous filaments, the shirt daubed with Nessus's blood that scorches the skin, wounding the susceptibilities. But what is the key that turns the lock of the poison dress? Who is us? Me and my mother. Three dreams. We're driving through large rolling hills in a big, soft, sloppy light toward the origin of family history. In this version, beautifully built barns straddle the road and we drive right through them, airy modern masterpieces open to and cleansing the heart and mind. What was the wolf chasing the sheep running up the grassy hillside? And I'm watching from the left of the scene, saying to my daughter, "Look at that wolf, it's hunting a sheep." Being the watcher and also the place I'm watching from is what's important. M. I do not dream I am dismembered. I never dream I am dismembered. So that's the sort of opening. And this is a list of called names and aliases. Helene Papamarku, birth certificate. Eleni, her father called her. Elaine, her mother called her. Elaine, her mother called her. Elaine, at death. The Golden Greek, stage name. Marco the Cat Girl, stage name. Melena the Leopard Girl, stage name. Melanie the Snake Dancer, stage name. Melini the Mexican Mobster, stage name. Marco, this is actually from her Denver show. Marco the Exciting Uncensored Dance Delineator. Melaine Marco, exotic. Elaine Marco, sultry, exotic. Secret name, secret name. Yeguerete, true carnivorous beast. What is her girl name, maiden? What is her girl name, maiden? The feral child.
Oh, thank you. You guys are... I always feel like my mom's in the audience when people clap and... in the middle. It's wonderful. Okay, and I'm just going to read one other little section. Yeah. So one of the things that I thought about a lot, because her main stage presence was the Leopard Girl, was about ferility and domestication and where that happens in our human environment, especially for women of her era. By 1905, every small town in America had a cooch, a shed where young and not-so-young ladies danced the hoochie-coochie, wiggling their bodies like snakes. Muddy Waters, if you the hoochie-coochie man, you collect the money, you tend the shed. I got a black cat bone. I got a mojo, too. I got the Johnny Conqueror. I'm gonna mess with you. Who said hoochie-coochie means a drunk woman's genitals? It means a single mother's rent. Education required? None. Rules? Never leave money unattended. Never leave the club with a man when the club owner is watching. Pay your house fees on time and in full. You can consider yourself an independent contractor. If you want to get fancy, you can call yourself an ecdesiast. Quote, it might be a good idea to relate strip teasing in some way to the associated zoological phenomenon of molting, unquote, from Greek ekdesis, Mencken, 1940, OED. In the tradition of fertility goddesses, temple dancers, and sacred harlots, my grandmother began. Exactly which lines of community morality she stepped across is a subject the family does not talk about. My mother feigns ignorance. At the orphanages, she knew not to say what her mother did for a living, but to find equivalents. But here is my grandmother before me in her leopard mask, ears akimbo, whiskers sexily bristling, sly lift in the shoulder, a sliver of breast revealing half the earth in light, and we guess at the half in shadow. Is there a whiff of criminality? What she was engaged in was the libretto of the leg. As Descartes pointed out, body is divisible into the smallest of units. My grandmother's mind, however, was not. When she danced the ancient dances of Judea and Arabia, you might have seen her inner thigh or her dissectable chest, but you will never be able to divide her thoughts. And I'll end there.
Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.